Welcome to the annual budget hearings for the City and County of Denver's next fiscal year. This session of the annual budget hearings begins now.
Slowly for you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Welcome back, everyone. Here we are. We're here for Denver Human Services budget briefing, and I will just remind council members, we will do a round of questions after presentation, and depending on how many folks get in the queue, I'll institute a limit, and we'll go that route. We'll see how everything goes here. And and then we know the whole deal with getting questions submitted to Angela. If you don't get your questions answered, definitely get them submitted to her by the end of day tomorrow, or by midnight tomorrow, I should say, for you to get a response in a few days. With that said, I'm going to turn it over to Director Braga and or Mayor.
No, you are in great hands with Director Braga. I'll give it over to her.
Just right on. Okay, great. So thank you so much, Anne-Marie Braga with Denver Human Services. I also have Clint Woodruff, our Chief Financial Officer, and Mimi Sherman, our Chief Operating Officer here for the phone a friend option, if that shall occur. And I'm really excited to be here. I've almost been here a year in this job, not quite, 11 months, I know. It has been a wild ride, you guys. I really have appreciated and just want to extend my thank you not only to the mayor's office and all the support we get from them, but also to city council members through my learnings as I'm in this role and through the newcomer response. And we've been in the trenches last year together, and it's fun to stand up here and share a little bit more with you about our budget. I know I was in front of you about a month ago doing a DHS 101. Most of you were there, but not all. So I've tried to tailor this presentation to not getting too much into the programmatic weaves part, but I will still do a couple of overview things just to make sure. And also I just want to say a lot goes into this budget process, y'all. Like, this is like, I'm so impressed with the professionalism of the Department of Finance, our team, just how everyone pulls together to like make this thing happen. So big shout out to everybody who helped put this together. Yeah, it's been great. Okay, let's get going. So it's funny, I put this slide up and one of our chief operating officer had asked, Cindy had asked, you have put up the slides that actually have, that you have to do with city council. You don't put up all of their priorities. And I'm like, no, these are them. So this is cool. Like, we are really aligned with seven of the eight priorities. And so I'm just gonna go through just a few items each. So with strengthening communities and engaging with neighborhoods, we've of course got our neighborhood resource sites, which we'll talk about in a minute, where we get folks services in the community. On the second one, improving customer service and empowering communities, we have a call center where we take calls, and we're going to talk more about that too, and some exciting things going on there. And we also do something called our Document Runner program, where we actually send staff out to folks in the community to either get a signature and get a document and bring it back, or for us to bring them documents for folks who are homebound. So that's really exciting stuff. We also, in our housing, number three, we have a general assistance program where we can get folks relief a little bit quicker than TRUA and some of those programs. And then we also support our housing navigation with our IDD population as well, individuals with developmental disabilities. We also, number four, empowering workers and supporting small businesses, we have a great program. It's really one of my favorites. It's called SNAP to Success, and it helps our SNAP recipients receive skills so that they can do better in their lives and get jobs and then not need us anymore, right? We're kind of trying to work ourselves out of a job if possible. And then we also have Human Together grants that support nonprofits for resource navigation that fits under that. With our climate action, you might say, well, what's DHS doing with climate action? When we're revitalizing Castro, we're making sure that we'll be LEED certified, which is Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. We also have electric fleet vehicles, of course, and we are also getting charging stations at some of our locations, which is new. Our staff have been asking for that quite a bit. And then number six, increasing access to health and behavioral health resources. We do this quite a bit as well with our child welfare core services. We also have outreach case coordinators in our resource prevention and engagement group that go out and help with navigation and those sorts of things as well, and help with some of our toughest cases, actually. And then our last one, investing in children, youth, and families. I mean, that's what we do. And child welfare, our visiting nurses program, there's many examples. So just wanted to show you my homework on how I could prove that we really are so aligned with all of you. So what are our 2025 priorities? So first of all, it's really important that we align, obviously, with the mayor's priorities, but then also yours as well. And we are going through strategic planning right now. I'm excited to show, we're both asking, you know, talking with our staff and our teams who've been doing this work a long time, what do you all think is important we should be focusing on? But we're also talking to our clients and customers. We've been doing interviews in the lobby. We've also sent out a survey to all of our programs and to the clients. And we got over 500 folks, which is really high for us. We've never gotten at this scale to have 500 of our clients share with us their thoughts on what they want to see. And I just wanted to share a little bit of data with you. 72% of those folks who answered, those 500 folks, said that they're getting what they need from us. The mayor and folks know, like, I want an A student, so like that's not good enough to me, but it's pretty good, but we're gonna do better. 76%, so three quarters feel that they're treated respectfully, and then 74%, almost three quarters, are overall satisfied with DHS services. Part of the reason I wanted to do that is just making sure that the priorities we choose are really valid and make sense to the people that we're serving. So that's important to us. So what are the priorities? The first one is we want to make sure that we're delivering timely services with excellence to the people of Denver. And what that means is that we make it easier, we make it faster to access both the state, local, state, and federal benefits. So we're really excited. You're going to get a little preview here, and anyone who's watching, that we are going to be launching My Friend Ben, which some of you might have heard of. I know the mayor loves this program and is excited about this as well, with Gary Community Ventures. And what this does is it helps people determine their eligibility for government services, and it can include, we can add whatever we want in Denver. So we could talk with some of the other programs, some of the sister agencies we have, and say, hey, do you want to put this in there and try to figure out how can we have a person fill out one thing and they actually find out what they're eligible for. So we're super excited about this. The second priority is we really need to be supporting our workforce. We want to make sure that they are engaged. They have the chance to be innovative. So we are adding, and I'll show you in just a minute with our org chart, but we have just hired our first inaugural culture and well-being officer position that will be overseeing our communications, our equity, diversity, and inclusion work, and then also our wellness. So some of you, and I know how hard the work is that the people at Human Services do. They're dealing with tough stuff on a daily basis. And so it's important that we make sure that those folks are well and they have the resources they need to process through trauma. You know, I'm sure many of you heard there was a shooting outside our lobby, outside the building not that long ago, just a couple weeks, 3 weeks now maybe. That's scary to folks. We just did a town hall, which is one reason I'm wearing my Broncos gear, because we had a spirit day today. And in talking with our folks, you know, that's something, safety is important. And just how to deal with the psychological side of that, not just safety. So we're really excited about this position. We also want to focus on leadership development, and I say up and down the org chart, because when I say leadership development, I'm not just talking about the highest level leaders of the department. Anyone can be a leader from any chair that they're in, but we want to start with folks who are managing other people. And that's something that we've had, you know, with COVID and with the newcomer work, we haven't had the time to really invest in those things as much as we'd like, and we're starting to do that now. And then lastly, we've got this posting and maintaining a public-facing dashboard, so any of you, anybody in the community can look and say, how's DHS doing, what are they focusing on, and how's it going? And then also, we're going to be breaking ground on Castro revitalization finally. It's funny, I did hear this has been in the workings for a little bit now, and it's actually going to be happening. So we met with the architects, we're on route to have an RFP out to then break ground and do all of that. So we're very, very excited about that. Okay, one other thing that I want to share before I move slides is what's not on here, and this is a question I feel like council asks quite a bit, and I am right in alignment with the thinking, is just how do we partner with our, what I used to say at the state, sister agencies or other agencies of the city. It's not my belief that government should ever work in silos, and too often because of funding streams and such, it ends up that way. That is not the way I work. Those of you that you know me over the last year, work very closely with all of our other agencies. So some examples are Dwight Jones and Karen McGowan and I have been meeting with our teams around prevention, around the youth system, violence prevention, really trying to, and honestly, for the first meeting, we were just like, what do you do exactly? You know, because we know some things that are out there, but some of the things that DHS does, Dwight didn't even realize, you know, Director Jones did not even realize in that conversation. And so it was really helpful, and we're getting to this place of like synergy and trying to figure out whose role is what in the prevention lane within primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. Another example is with HOST. Director Reif and I worked a lot, obviously, on newcomer work, but also with the property tax relief program, which I was talking about on the break, that we're really looking at where does it best belong, and it might best belong over there, and so we're just figuring it out, right? That's one of the things I've said time and time again about my role here is I think the mayor and this is not about me, but he did a great job hiring folks. The people that I work alongside, but seriously, the people I work alongside are some of the most amazing, selfless individuals. I've never worked with a team that has territorial is the word I'm looking for. They're not territorial about their work. It's like, what is best? Does it work there? Can we do that? Is it going to save money and time and people are going to be better served? Let's figure it out. So I'm just really excited about that work. Also with Dottie, the affordability programs, trash rebates, sidewalks. Sometimes folks ask, why is DHS doing that? So we're kind of having those conversations. Where does it best belong? Does it make sense? However it's going to be most efficient and effective is what we want. So we're working on that too. And then of course at OSEI, Dr. Sanders, he helped envision that cultural officer position. We work together on that as well. And then I know with the violence prevention and some of those things we're working on too. So those are just a smattering of ways that, of priorities that I have that might not, it might show up in our plan. We'll see. But I just wanted you to know that are there. Okay, quick agency background. So vision and mission. These have been our vision and mission for quite some time. We're actually looking, we had a big meeting today actually about changing our vision potentially. A lot of times people still read this and go, but we don't know what you do. And so we're talking about potentially changing the mission. The vision we like a lot, and it's bold or it's you know broad, but we're taking a look at this in that process I just described that we're going through. So more to come if that shifts. Again, just really quickly, we have 1,300 budgeted, 1,304, sorry, I know all those numbers matter, but we have budgeted FTEs, and then here just shows we really break this up by people, program operations, and then finance. And then under the program operations, just to remember, we do assistance, and under assistance is things like food, medical assistance, cash, child support, and these local programs. And then under prevention and protection is where we have child welfare, adult protection, and our resource and engagement and prevention program. And then under finance, something else Clint has in his back pocket and experience is operations. So we moved operations from under our Chief Operating Officer, Mimi, and moved them under Clint. So he also oversees our facility safety and security and our performance improvement and accountability. So it just kind of shows you generally. And then, of course, we have our awesome city partners with human resources and legal. Okay. So I think you've all heard this. This is just know that we serve 1 in 3 people in Denver. I think that's really an important data point. Demographics are mostly adult, 18 to 59, Latino mostly. 75% are BIPOC. Half are women, half are men generally. We do collect some data on non-binary, but I don't think it's accurate, and we're going to be working on that too. The data we collect is really important, especially in the equity, diversity, and inclusion realm. So we are, our Lisa Piscopo, who is on our team, is also working a lot on trying to figure out what is the right data. But she put this together. Big shout out to her. This is our index that shows where people face more obstacles. And I just want to give you, this gets shown to you a lot, but I just want to take the opportunity now to share with you some of the examples of the metrics that are used. So we collect things in the health bucket, which is things like teen birth, uninsured, in the education, these are just examples, there's more than that, but a couple. Education, we collect third grade reading scores, graduation rates, those kinds of things. And then the community, it's internet access, employment, and housing. And when I say we collect, we analyze, we're not... We get that data from other places, but and then we put this together, and the darker areas are the areas with fewer opportunities or more obstacles for folks. So we made sure I wasn't here yet, but I was so excited when I heard that we used data to open up where our sites are, because sometimes people just open something up because it sounds like a good idea to go there. So I'm really proud of the fact that DHS has locations in or near most of those areas. So we're working really hard on that. And just to say, our goal in that is we just want to make it easy, right? I said that earlier, but really making it easy to get access to services and get the support that people need. So here are our clients served by our assistance program. So I talked to you about the different areas. We've got assistance, and then we've got prevention protection. These are the assistance programs. And I just want to share a little bit. This is a point in time. So in July 2024, this is the number of medical assistant to 212,000 folks. That is up 20,000 from pre-pandemic. So I just want to let you know kind of where that lands. I thought about this later, didn't include it on the slide here, so I want to make sure I say it out loud. Food assistance is at 150 or about 116, and that's up 28,000 from pre-pandemic times. And then Colorado Works with temporary assistance for needy families, it's up 1,500, so it used to be about 8,500. And then child care assistance is back where it had been, so that's stable. But just to give you an idea of the numbers that we're serving through these programs. Oops, that's the wrong button. Okay. So there's a couple of inaccurate numbers on this, so I just want to make sure y'all know that we just made an error. And first I wanted to share prevention and protection. Child welfare gets a lot of space and time because there's a lot of budget that goes there. So hence, you get one slide in this area today. This is the one I'm showing. But I just want you to know that the adult and aging and that and adult protection is really important to us as well. I'm actually going to be meeting with Director Gaylor soon. We're talking about how do we, with HRCP and with other folks across the city, how are we focusing on that population? That population is exploding. It's not just because I'm getting there and I want a system that works for me, because we're all getting old, right? But how do we make sure that we're supporting those folks? So I'm going to be talking about child welfare, but I just don't want to leave out that adult protection and our adult work is very important as well. It just doesn't take up quite as much of our budget, which honestly is going to be a problem if we have the right. So we're thinking of that and talking about it. So I just wanted you to be aware of that. And then also in prevention and protection, we have our resource engagement and prevention work, which I talked about earlier, but it's the budget is much smaller. So for this presentation, I'm focusing on this. So just wanted to share this funnel graph, which I think, or a chart, which I think y'all have seen before. But what this, the big takeaways here, assessments, the actual number is 3649, and then the open cases, luckily it's not 1,000 open cases, we have 396 open cases. So that's a huge difference, and it's a lot lower, thank goodness.
This
data is from July 2023 to June of 2024. It's a year, yeah, thank you for asking that. And then the court involved, we have 240, so there's a few less there as well. But the big takeaways that I want you to know here is that only 10% of our assessments or our assigned cases lead to an open case. So that means 90% of those caseworkers connect with those families and help them receive other supports. So when we have someone call and, you know, this is happening to this family, we say, that's not a child welfare thing. We don't just say, see you later. We say, well, that sounds like the parent might need some support, right? We want to prevent and make sure that it doesn't turn into that. So I just wanted you all to know that we're doing a lot of work around the prevention piece and making sure that our prevention teams are supporting. Nicole's impressed with that. That's cool. I saw that face. Thank you. Yeah, I was excited, too, to hear how much prevention we're doing. I still think prevention is one of the areas that, in general, for the city, we need more money because if we spent, this is my 15 years of public health, but if we spent more money here, we wouldn't be doing all this over here. But it's hard to make that shift when you're trying to help people in the moment, so I get it. All right. It's time for Clint. This is great. Clint Woodruff, come on up. I'll move my, sorry, nails are not long. Do you want me to do this?
Sure.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Hello, everyone. Pleasure to be here this afternoon. I'm Clint Woodruff. Been here all 4 months, so I will probably have all of your answers for sure. So talking about our budget, just want to look at it a few ways. First is by funding source, and how do we get our money? What does our money look like? A couple things of note here. First, about half of all of our funds come from state and federal sources, and those are due our mandated programs that are mandated, you know, in law that we do as a county, like TANF and food assistance and different things like that, and we get that passed on through the state to us. The other thing to note here is that we don't have any general fund. I think maybe some people did not realize that, but we really don't have any general fund whatsoever in our funding for next year. And then finally, most of all of our other money comes from mill levies. Do see a large balance coming from fund balances, but that's really associated with transfers, and we'll get into that a little bit later on the next slides. So, what is the problem with not having general funds or other growing sources is that we rely heavily on our mill levy numbers and our state and federal pass-through dollars. What we're experiencing right now is a very flat source of revenues, right? So the revenues at the state and federal level are not growing, and our mill levy right now, at least, is projected to be mostly flat for next year. These are our major programs that we receive state and federal dollars from. You'll notice that for child welfare, there is a small increase here, a couple million dollars this year. That is all associated with the bill that passed this last session to better serve high acuity youth and to pay the vendors the appropriate dollars to provide those services to the children that need those services. Colorado Works, you'll see, or otherwise TANF, you may know as TANF, is flat. County Admin is up some, as I think we got about $1.5 million or $1.8 million there. However, for at least the last decade, that number has been $10 million or more less than what we actually need to run our program in programs for eligibility in County Admin. And CCAP is down, so child care is down because of the ARPA funding that went away after the end of the public health emergency. And that is going to be especially problematic for us in the future because we're seeing a lot of legislative changes that are increasing these costs, such as mandated pay for enrollment, not attendance. So right now we pay for attendance based on how many days you are actually utilizing your care. Future, the rules will require that we pay for enrollment, so you pay for the whole month. To mirror what you would see in the private sector, or just if you were a private payer versus the public payer, so that business can count on that direct stream of revenues. And then the other big change is the increasing rates. Over the next 3 years, we will see a mandated increase of about 33% rates for us. So those increasing costs combined with what are currently flat revenues are definitely concerns for us and things that we are going to have to look at in the future. And we're looking at processes. We're advocating at the state and federal level for increased funds. And we're doing a lot of things to try and address that. In the interim, we'll be using our fund balance to cover those expenditures that exceed these revenues that we're receiving. But we can only do that for so long. That's not a completely sustainable strategy. So this is another way. This is our slide. It's an ode to Justin Sykes because he created this slide view, I believe, and we like it, so we thought we'd keep it in here. It's another way of looking at how is our spend going to occur. We did make one change a little bit. We did want to separate the transfers out. So you see that our budget is like $297.2 million, I think, something like that. $297 million for this year. $51.5 million of that is transfers from one of our funds to whatever it may be. In the case of the newcomers program, that's $22 million going back to the general fund out of that fund. In the case of our mill levy fund balance, we have $10 million going technically into the newcomers program to help cover the expenses until we receive reimbursement for FEMA. And we have $4.5 million going to the property tax rebate program, which we'll talk a little bit about later, but various different transfers that we wanted to just highlight that really our operational budget is about $245 million when you take those transfers out, that is just moving one money from one fund to another, which I'm sure will be spent in many ways, but not necessarily by DHS in our operations. So our actual budget actions. The first one is something that we're very proud of, the accomplishments that have been made using on-call staff. We have made some changes call center for our eligibility programs. And Amory was going to take, is all right if I show you? Okay, so Amory really wanted to talk about this herself because she's so proud of the work that the team has done. About a year ago, or in January, our average wait times were about 53 minutes when somebody called in. And that resulted in, I think, about 37% of calls just being dropped because people can only wait so long and they get very frustrated. Through the addition of folks, through the changes in processes, and looking at more efficient ways of doing the things we're doing, and different accommodations we made for staff and how we do our work, we this last month were under 8 minutes. We were at 53 minutes to 8 minutes with only having 10% drop call rate. Healthcare policy and finance wants us to get below 5 minutes. We want to get below 5 minutes, and we're going to get there, and we're very, very close to getting there. In addition to these people that have helped the call center by doing all that work on the front end of the call center, it's helping relieve some of the stress for the people in the lobby, and the work they're doing in the lobby is getting better and better as well, as along with process refinement. Another stat that I love to provide is I believe it was this time last year, roughly, I may be not exactly right on the date, our redetermination rate, timeliness rate, was at like 17%. So one out of every five people were getting their eligibility redeterminations done timely. As of this last month, we are over 95%. And so that's an incredible transformation to go from one way, one extreme to another. And we've just been on the phone with the state recently, who's given us some recognition about this tremendous improvement is not only great for Denver, but it's also moving the needle for the entire state, because the feds are looking at these type of measurements for the funding that we receive. So we're helping move and improve the overall performance of the state by improving our residents' experience.
I just want to reiterate, as from 53-minute wait time to 8-minute wait time is a 95% cut in wait time in 6 months, which is remarkable.
It is pretty amazing, and clearly it is because I came to work here.
We can give you the applause.
Clap to you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. All right. Before I move off this slide, what we'd like to do is take those 13 people that we've been doing as temporary employees and make them permanent staff, make these changes permanent, and that will cost about $938,000. Next item that we would talk about is the property tax rebate program. Ann-Marie mentioned this a little bit about where does it maybe belong or not belong. And historically, this had been a generally funded program through 2021. And then in 2021, there was about $1 million that would come out of the mill levy fund that, and be transferred into this fund, and about $2 million worth of general fund augmented that, and then the rest, it just worked from its fund balance. Last year, there was virtually no general fund there. We transferred out for TRUA, which we'll talk about later, $1 million for TRUA, and we operated almost solely off of the fund balance. The end result of that is that the fund balance is going to be depleted, given the situation of where we're at budgetarily this year and with our revenues. Human Services would like to fund the entire $4.5 million out of our fund balance from mill levies for this year. It's not an ongoing strategy, but it is at least a one-year strategy where we can help hopefully relieve some of the stress on the general fund for this year. And so we're proposing to fund, and that's approximately exactly 1 year's worth of costs for this next year out of the fund balance. All right. One of our priorities, I think, was the fifth priority that you saw, was let's break ground on the Castro revitalization. I believe it's been in discussions for many, many years. Last year we hopefully temporarily took $15 million out of our capitalization fund there and moved it to help with the newcomer program. But now we're ready to put it back in and continue with our bid. We've run our RFP process and we're getting to the point where we're going to select a vendor and their bid. So we'd like to put the money back into, the fund, and therefore be capable to proceed with those vendors. This will allow us to be adherent with the ADA regulations that we're out of compliance with at our building currently. The building is rather old, so these are newer regulations that we need to get up to speed with. It will improve our experience. The whole focus of the project builds around the lobby and then out, so it'll improve our customer experience and it'll improve our employee satisfaction because they'll have nicer spaces to work in and more modernized space. Okay. Then we kind of just clumped the rest of ours together because there's a lot of small ones. So I'm just going to go through exactly what we're doing, what we're thinking here. The top one is $750,000. That's all ARPA funding that the Healthcare Policy and Finance has offered to us to finish the, wind down, I would say, of the public health emergency. And so we add. This time last year had about 30% more cases in Medicaid assistance than we have now. But all of those people that were on Medicaid assistance because of the public health emergency rules and qualified because of the special circumstances now have to be reevaluated and their benefits determined given the standardized rules, I guess, for lack of better terminology. And so for the next 6 months, the Healthcare Policy and Finance has offered to, for the first 6 months of the year, has offered to augment our staff to finish that work and get us back to stabilized caseload. The next category, so that's a one-time federal dollars. The next category are extension of some temporary items that we had going on. So these are all temporary employees. There's about six programs that will total $1.1 million. The reason we've asked to extend these as temporary as opposed to drop them or make them permanent is because there's been a lot of stuff going on. We had COVID go on, we had a newcomers program go on, we had a new mayor come in, we just had a new executive director, and now I'm here. And we don't really have what we consider the appropriate data to make the decisions on whether we should continue these programs going forward or not. There is data, but I don't know that we've had enough time to compose it and analyze it appropriately. So expect us to either come back and ask in the future for extension of these as permanent items or to let them fall off. But we do need just to operate for one more year while we get all of that data and really commit to a culture of making those data-driven decisions. Then finally, it is the permanent requests that we're making. These are net of decreases that are occurring, as well things that we are letting expire. The two things that we're adding here is a small increase to our paid internship program. It had about a $311,000 budget. Historically, we'd like to make it permanent as a pilot. We've had some good success with that. We'd like to make it permanent, and it with a budget of about $375,000. And then the other thing that we're really proud of and think is an incredible investment to make in our team is a leadership program, formal leadership training for our supervisors, because we have people that just do great jobs at their work. You know, they might be a great eligibility professional and they're amazing and off the charts, and then we make them a supervisor because they are so good at what they do, but they really have never received the training and the guidance of how to be a supervisor. And that's what this is really geared at. Is it'll be all levels of management, but it's really geared at that frontline supervisors, those first-time supervisors, teaching them how to be a supervisor and the right way to, you know, handle tough conversations or work with your staff in that manner. So that summarizes the remainder of our requests, and I believe Emery would like to talk about the items.
Yeah, thank you so much, Clint. I have a couple of things I want to share, and then Clint's going to do a few more budget pieces as well. So I just wanted to share a couple of changes with the newcomer program. As of January 1st, I see my friend and colleague back there, HRCP, Perla Gaylor, and I are going to be working together over the next few months with our PEAK program. We are going to be transferring the newcomer program to HRCP starting January 1st. I know many of you, we've had conversations, have been asked about this. We were actually here, I think, a year ago. Well, I wasn't here quite yet. So like October, we were having these conversations about doing this, working with PEAK, trying to transfer it over. And then all of a sudden we got, you know, Operation Lone Star, like, thrown right in our face. And so then we were like, okay, let's just figure this thing out. And then we all bonded and got super close and worked very hard to help a lot of people. And as I stand here with a budget slide, like I do, I look at Justin and just his face, he'd make at me when I was like, what is happening? And I was like, what job did I take? And I learned so much. And here we are a year later being able to talk about it because of the amazing success that we as a city had. There's just a lot in there. I could tell a story about every person at this table about how grateful I am for that work. Oh, yes.
Time check. Hoping in about 10 minutes we
have
to
take questions. Less than that. Yeah. Sorry. And I'm going into my lane. She's like, she's going into memory lane. So I will just tell you the two changes. Sorry. I can't help it. It's like, you know, when you go through trauma, it's too hard of a word, but when you go through stuff, it brings up feelings, and y'all know I'm a feeler. So yes. So I'll just say it, very grateful to have had that experience, honored to have done the work. I'm really excited where we are now and where we're able to transfer it to HRCP and Doira, who really understand the work of this community so well. So we're going to be partnering together over the next few weeks to figure that out. This has all been decided since all the budget slides too. So what Clint's going to present on in a second still has a couple of things. So the second big change, that's the first big change. The second big change is because we're moving it there, we don't need the mayoral appointee anymore. And so Sarah Plastino's last day will be December 31st. She has been a rock star, and when we talked to her about it, she's like, that makes total sense. When she was hired, I told her, don't know how long we're going to need this position, but can you come help us? And she made a very valiant effort and a lot of great outcomes with this work. And so we wish her the best, but she will be moving on January 1st. So Victoria Aguilar and the rest of the folks who are hired, there's six FTE who will be moving over at that point to continue with the DAS program for quarter one. And over the next few months, we're going to determine, what does it look like after quarter one? What is, like, now the settled kind of, what kind of program do we as Denver want? I think one of the things we really learned is that there are a lot of folks, and we knew this, but it was more in our face, there's a lot of folks in Denver who have been needing legal clinics for many years. So how do we support those folks, right? So we're working on trying to figure this out. We've learned a lot through the process, and we're excited to be in this space. So just wanted to share those two kind of big-ish announcements to make sure you know what's happening. And again, all of this is not reflected yet in the budget slides, but Clint will go over some of the details. It was funny, I was gonna do the budget slides because I'm like, I know this stuff, and then I heard him describe it and I'm like, wow, he's even more in the weeds about it, so I feel like he'll be able to do a better job. So Clint, we're gonna pass it off again. And thank you for learning it so quickly. He just figured it out.
Thank you, thank you. Okay, we'll quickly go here since we have very few minutes left. The budget next year proposed is $12.5 million. That is not including the $22 million transfer that we talked about that would be going out back to the general fund. A couple of items of note to know here is, as Anne-Marie was just referring to, that upper right-hand box there that talks about the $4.5 million for the Denver Asylum Seekers Program. That would be the continuation and completion of the first cohort that started, just recently started, and so through the first quarter operations there. In the newcomer program itself, there's a $1.7 million listed there. That includes administration and staff. There's already some vacancy savings there with the decision that Anne-Marie mentioned about Sarah Plastino. And additionally, there's a kind of a little bit of an unknown number here, but this is our best guess at it. We had about 590 on-call employees working for the last year tirelessly to help this population. And they are no longer working with us. That means there will most likely be some unemployment claims. We've already started to see it. So we've earmarked $600,000 there just in case to cover those things going into next year. And finally, the $5 million number is very important to note. It's strictly contingency funds, which will depend on, you know, the newcomer environment itself and what programs or decisions are made with the program itself, but right now are not earmarked for any dollars or any actual operations. And that obviously will change as time develops, but it's still part of that 12.5. Here are the changes, and I believe Anne-Marie actually touched on all these in combination with myself, but we talked about the transfer to the general fund, talked about the contingency fund, we talked about the first quarter of the DAS program, what the newcomer program itself will look like as some administration. We will be tailoring back the sheltering and onward travel services and moving more to these legal services, which is the next box. And finally, the Department of Housing and Stability Outreach Program will continue. That's with Dottie, but that work will continue as well. So I think all of that has already been covered. Last couple of slides. Moving on from newcomers and on to the other items, we're asked to talk about strategies for mitigating impacts of the 2025 reductions. As we mentioned, what things we're trying to do as an agency, and we've talked about these already, to help with the stress on the general fund this year is transfer $22 million back from the newcomers program to the general fund, transfer $10 million from our mill levy fund to cover the costs until such time we can receive the FEMA reimbursement dollars, which is a process in itself, and then finally to fund the $4.5 million for the property tax rebate program, the affordability programs that we discussed earlier. So hopefully the combination of those three things will help with our general fund situation across the city. Whoops. I lied, there's three slides too, by the way. A look back, a question of what were the impacts of TRUA and how did that impact our department? And then for us, it was all really about that property tax rebate program. So the $1 million that was transferred to TRUA leaves us with a zero balance in that fund. And we've already talked about extensively about replacing that with a $4.5 million one time for next year. And by doing this, the combination of doing this, we don't anticipate any interruption in services or any adverse effects to either our clients or our staff next year. Last item was ARPA updates, and we have a $400,000 worth of ARPA left to spend. It's on the community benefit, well, not to spend, sorry, the award. We spent some of it already. It's the community benefits navigation pilot program. We've entered into contracts with these four vendors: Bayad Enterprises, Focus Points Family Resources Center, the Community Firm, and Work Life Partnership. to be navigators out in the community to connect people to the benefits that they may be eligible for but don't realize they're eligible for, and really make sure that the people that are eligible and in need of our services are aware that they're available and how to connect to them. With that, we move on to questions.
1 minute to spare.
1 minute to spare. Let's go.
All right. Thank you so much, Director Braga. I was laughing and I said, that's how you know she's a social worker, because I do the same thing all the time. I just started talking about everything. You can ask my husband, who's like, can you just get to the point? To me, yeah, all the time. But no, it's great to hear all of the wonderful things that DHS is doing. With that said, like I said, right now I won't institute the two question because I think we're doing good, but I will, if I have to cut people off, if you're taking like, you know, 20 minutes of time, then I might say, okay. But we'll start with Councilwoman Sawyer, followed by Councilwoman Albigares.
Thanks, Madam Chair. No questions. I just wanted to say thank you. I truly appreciate your willingness to work with HOST and with other agencies to try and find the right home for some of these programs that you guys have been managing, and your willingness to cover the $4.5 million for next year so that we can ensure that people have this really important anti-displacement tool in the property tax rebate and have that continue seamlessly. So thank you. You, from the bottom of our hearts, we truly appreciate your partnership and your creativity and your willingness to help figure this out so that we can get this money to our residents.
That's it.
Thanks.
Great.
Councilwoman
Alvarez,
and after you is Councilwoman.
Thank you, Committee Chair. Thank you for sharing all of this. As someone that's still learning about city departments, it's processing a lot. One of the things I'm curious about, so it's $22 million that was allocated to you all for the migrants that is now going back to the general fund. Did I understand that correct?
Yes.
And what was that money intended originally for?
All right, let me answer that for you. So you may recall, Councilwoman, we actually came to City Council in April of this past year. That is where we went through with every agency that was contributing to the newcomer fund. It was really early. We were trying to plan for both covering the dollars under that we'd already made sure that we had underway of spending, and we were developing the DAS program at that time. So you may recall that we were really pricing out things like shelter and food based on projected census of folks, and then began to really form the DAS program. So the short story is that we had intended to build the newcomer program and had used those dollars to make sure we could be responsive. And then as we began to tighten up the DAS program, and quite frankly, fewer people were coming, we were able to then release those $22 million.
Okay, I am going to say I am worried about transferring those funds out so quickly, because I do think there's still a need, and I'm worried about what happens 6 months in when we are not helping them with their rent anymore. So I am concerned about that. One question just for learning for myself is, when you have on slide 9 where you have 13,000 referrals and then it goes down to 3,700 assessments, like, what is that huge disparity? What happens with those other 10,000 individuals?
Yeah, so this is the one that's had the wrong number. So the 13,000 to now 3,600, right? Is that the one you're talking about?
Right, yep, that's the one that you have in your hand.
Yeah, it's a little bit less. Okay, yeah. So the 13,000, so I'm like, I'm feeling Mimi, because this is Mimi's expertise, but I'm going to try to do it without her. So 13,000 referrals, those are not unduplicated. So there's a lot of, so sometimes like 3 or 4 people will call on one person. So it's not 13,000 individuals, if that makes sense. And people will sometimes call for various reasons. Like my kid didn't, like, not my, a child at school has come to school 5 days in a row without a coat, and it's cold, right? And that is important to bring up, but it doesn't necessarily mean you open an assessment for the family, because it's something that we can, when I mentioned the prevention team, we can refer to say, let's get this family resources and make sure that they have what they need, but it doesn't rise to the level of an assessment.
What kind of would be the assessment, just to follow up on that?
What would
rise to a level of assessment?
I want you to answer that if you're going to answer. Yeah, I don't want to try to guess on that one. I mean, I could say as a social worker what I think, but I've never been a child welfare worker, and Mimi was, and led it. So I'm going to let her tell you that.
Hi, everyone. Mimi Sherman, Chief Operating Officer. We have a volume 7, which is very thick, about all the different things that rise to the level of abuse and neglect. And when you talk about a child not having a coat, it doesn't rise to that level. It's really, this family needs some additional resources. How do we find those? And quite frankly, we don't want families in the child welfare system if they don't belong in our system. It's really intense. It's not always as helpful as it wants to be, because we have limited resources, and those, we will make sure that we get them the help they need. We will connect them. We will educate school. We will get them connected with resources they can connect families to. So we do a lot of work there. But what rises to those levels is pretty specific, and it's a pretty high threshold.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Committee Chair. And if I could get back in the queue. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Councilwoman. Councilwoman Torres.
I'm okay.
Put your hands up.
Thank you.
He's like, thanks for drawing attention to
me. Water back there. Someone should get him water.
I have like 7 things of water.
Oh, he's not water.
He's got too much water.
Because he's trying to get out of here.
I'm glad we got to all of you. Archie, it's like Thursday in the afternoon. Y'all are ready to be done with these things.
Councilwoman Torres, you're
up. You. I have 2 questions, but they each have 3 parts. First is just my thanks about the development toward creating a satellite space in the Westwood Community Center. I think that's outstanding. I think it is the right location and the perfect population to have quick and immediate access to somebody to answer questions or help fill out forms, whatever the question kind of might be. So I appreciate that. And that's exactly what we wanted out of a Westwood Community Center. So thank you for helping us realize that dream as well. One question about the chief culture and well-being officer. So in the news release that I saw, they're going to be responsible for EDI efforts of the department. There's also an EDI administrator underneath them in your org chart. The concern I have about each department basically having their own chief equity officer is its competition or divergence from Dr. Saunders and the city's chief equity office and Office of Social Equity and Innovation. I've tried to be very vigilant about looking at how Parks, CPD, Host, they've all wanted their own EDI person. And one of the concerns around that is those people can be very, if they're not under the supervision of Dr. Saunders as a Chief Equity Officer of the city, they can create their own new definitions of equity. They can create new kind of protocols. That can be a little challenging. The other is you start to lose the obligation that everyone owns that work, as opposed to, oh, our EDI person will take care of that, right? Or be the eyes on that. So that's my question to you. It sounded like Dr. Saunders worked hand in hand with you in creating that, but I don't know if there is, like, what your expectation of is of that person in working directly with under the city's protocols and priorities as opposed to developing your own.
Yeah, great question. So first of all, I've done EDI work in big systems for many years now, and it's one of the reasons I like do this work actually, and I've hired different folks at various levels, and I agree with you, it's gotta be, people are like, do we weave it into everything or do we have it on its own thing? My philosophy is you have to have both. You have to do both until it actually is woven in. So it doesn't get woven in unless it's someone's responsibility to help make sure it's woven in. And as much as these guys know, I talk about it all the time and I'm like the champion. As an ED, I've learned a lot in the last year. I don't have the capacity to do that on its own. So I did meet with Dr. Saunders, right away, and I asked him, my intention is to use all of the definitions from the city and to align exactly. His team actually helped hire the person, so I made sure that they were part of the hiring process. We actually are doing a training for equity and inclusion right now, and in order to hire the trainer, we did in partnership with him as well. We had them as part of it. So I've been in his shoes trying to wrangle all the different people. So I come from it in a very humble way and not saying we're gonna go do our own thing, but we have 1,300 employees. His team does not have the capacity to actually help all of our folks. I'm here for however long I'm here for, but you know, I'm in one of those appointee positions so that I can, so even if I wanted to stay for 10 years, that's not a thing. So I wanna make sure that in the time that I'm here, we do the right work for the people. And so I'm really excited about this for that reason. The other thing I'd call out, we called it culture and well-being because it includes wellness, which sometimes EDI does and sometimes it does not include it. It just depends on where you are. The EDI administrator that we had before felt that, you know, that it's too much for one human to do, right? It's like, and it's heavy, right? It's heavy and hard work. So making, and I know you know this, I'm just like processing it, but having a wellness person who can plan a 5K or who can do some mental health trauma stuff, some meditation, you know, all these various things, that's, I can't have one individual doing all that for 1,300 people. So instead I'm like breaking that up, and they're also overseeing our communications. And that was very strategic because we have a communications team and that could go in a lot of different places, but I really feel like, and I, from experience, I know that the words we use are so important and can do so much good or so much harm. With employee morale, with wellness, with all of that. And I felt like if one person was overseeing all those things together, we'd have a better shot at really making sure that everybody across the whole department knows and understands equity, diversity, and inclusion, and belonging, and all those things, wellness, and can do that. But until we have people whose job it is to help them do that, I don't see us getting there with that big of an organization. So that's why when I went to Dr. Sanders, I was like, I want to use your vision, because I didn't know him at first. I'm like, okay, I want to see it. People in EDI have all kinds of different thoughts and feelings and ways of going about it. He and I were like from the very first lunch. And so I was like, this is going to be awesome. So I'm really excited about this because it is aligned with him. And you can keep me honest. And if you're feeling or hearing differently, please tell me. But I have a lot of confidence because of our partnership. And also with Aaron Conley, who works for him, he's involved. He comes to all of our ERG meetings, so they're really integrated in. But Aaron doesn't have the capacity to do what we really want and need to be done, if that makes sense. So hopefully that helps describe, but I'll keep your thoughts in mind for sure as I move forward.
Okay. All right. Just this morning, I've like in our amendment process, I moved over money in prior years from human services. So it is a big deal for me. And a lot of that was also at, what felt like the, interest of the chief equity officer, right? Yeah. 'Cause they were also fielding. Parks was actively trying to get their own EDI director, and like it was happening, right? And so it felt very unwieldy, especially in the earliest years of OSEI. So just some history there. For newcomer budget, I don't see any movement of money, particularly to HRCP. So 6 people potentially moving over there, where is that money? And it's not just people, it's probably programmatic dollars, but I don't see that in the budget book.
Yeah, so that's what these changes and this conversation was happening after we had to submit everything. So even though it's not reflected in the budget book, all that money and all of that is going. We're not keeping that. So it's going over with.
So the $22 million is going back to the general fund, but is it going into HRCP?
Not the $22 million, no, but all of the other money that is associated is going to HRCP.
You may recall that when Justin did an overview of how we address some of the gap, for 2025, one-time funds was part of that solution. So we brought those dollars back to the general fund. It's no longer being used for newcomer work. The dollars that will be used for newcomer work is the $10 million that we just talked about here. It's actually 12.5 in total is being available for the newcomer budget for 2025. It is currently in the human services budget. Mostly it's a timing issue. So we will come back to you with a separate ordinance to put it in the right place.
Yeah.
Okay.
What?
It'll just be shown in the October budget.
Stephanie, can that be shown in the October budget? Right, because we get the September budget, and then after this we get an October budget, and then we see the actual budget, the final budget.
We'll work on it.
The end of October. Is it possible to do that?
Yeah, we'll follow up with you.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Councilwoman Parity.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you so much to DHS. It's nice to hear the full scope of your work because we were really so focused on newcomers, as you were too. Okay, so just choosing between my many questions. One question I wanted to follow up a little bit about was the IDD fund, which we learned about a lot about in the last budget cycle, IDDEAS. I know there have been thoughts about trying to use that for housing, which is such a need. I'm just curious if there's an update on progress there, partnerships, any of that.
Yes, so I actually prepared some information just to make sure that I could share. So just a general update is that we are, we serve more than 6,000 residents through that fund. Some of the things we've been able to do with it are things like commissioning assessments of developers or landlords to identify housing solutions for folks with individuals with developmental disabilities. I don't know how interested you are in this, but we're also expanding early childhood services too. Early intervention services are part of that. Long-term services and supports for individuals with disabilities. We've also, with our MHS's Denver START, provided crisis prevention and intervention services for Denver residents with IDD. So there's a wide array of things that this fund does. There also was data. I was asking for some data, and there were some things were not easily analyzed to be given today. And so one of the things we're working on across our department actually is what data we're collecting and what data should we be collecting and how we do that. So we want to be able to give you even further delineation of the data that for this program specifically. But I do have a chart. I don't think we put this as a slide. This one's not a slide. Yeah, I was going to say we did a lot of backup slides. But I do have like our fund balance, our expenditures with that program that I can share with you all as well, and just send you it's going really well. Michaela, who leads that program, is just, I mean, her team is fantastic, and they're working really hard to make sure that the money gets out to all the communities in a way that we're doing the right thing. And the board is also phenomenal. We have a fantastic board too. I feel like Justin is dying to share more because he knows so much about it. Or maybe you're just really happy you don't have to. But it's doing some really great stuff, and I'm happy to share more and share the slide with you. Like that.
I would love that slide, and I think I may actually just request a briefing like on that.
Yeah, we can totally do that.
Topic area more than a budget area. Sure. But I also, and this is again a little more programmatic, but just curious if I know we've, or I think we've been doing some screening for traumatic brain injury at House of Thousand Sites, and I wondered if we've done also IDD screening, because obviously, I mean, what I understand is that most people with IDD get diagnosed at a certain point and get this coverage, but if anyone were to be undiagnosed, I would kind of expect that.
That's a really great question. I know that Michaela and our team have been working with Joshua Posner and the team on all the ways that All in Mile High connect with ideas and how to make sure that we're.
Great.
But I don't know if that specific topic came up or not. I was not at that meeting, but I know that's happening. So I can check on that and get back to you.
Thank you.
That's a great question.
It's one of the benefits of providing services directly as the city.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I have some questions around the Child Care Assistance Program, so CCAP. 3,000 kids in 2024, same objective number for 2025. Just curious, what's kind of the limiting factor on how many kids we can provide those services for, and like why is that number flat rather than growing? Is it because there's no additional need, no additional funding, no additional providers? And that can be a follow-up too. But.
Yeah, no, it's a really good question, and it's something we're going to have to, I'm actually talking with the mayor about it next week. There's been some changes to the CCAP program at the federal level and at the state that we've been working with the Denver Preschool Program and some of our other agencies who do child care, because that's one of our, one of the things we really want to focus on this year. So what it's doing is a great thing. It's providing jump in if I'm messing this up, Clint, but it's providing more funding for providers. So there's a huge provider increase, which is fantastic because, as we know, providers actually used to run a child care center. So I've been in those shoes, and it's really hard. It's really expensive. People don't want to pay as much, you know. And then I've been a mom paying for child care, and it's like I'm basically working to pay for child care, right? I mean, many of us have been in those shoes. So I'm excited for the providers that they're getting additional funding. But guess what they're not doing? Is funding us more so we can keep the same level number of kids. So we will probably see a decrease in that. And we're trying to figure out the right balance of how we support it. You know, can we come in and use some fund balance to fund it? But then really the feds should be paying for this. There should be more money that comes from them with this mandate. So I know you're all familiar with unfunded mandates, and it's something that we're advocating for at the federal and state levels. So there's a lot more to come on this. I'm happy to do a briefing that goes into greater detail about this, but we're actually doing some stakeholdering with the child care centers in the area in Denver to ask them and talk to them about, you know, they know this is happening, but it might affect things such as our absences. So we pay for 8 absences currently. That's double a month, 8 absences a month per child. That's double what most folks do. Most counties are doing 4 absences a month. That could be a strategy that we use to get about $3.5 million back. Is that the right number? But we also are like, that's also going to affect families, right? Are they going to pass that on? There's a lot of pieces to this puzzle. And so we're starting with, as a good social worker would, and talking to the people who are most affected by it and asking the questions and partnering with those folks before we make any final decisions. So those conversations are happening over the next few weeks. And then we're going to, so I know that wasn't, I don't know if I'm answering your question exactly, but I'm just sharing with you like all the things that are happening with the program. There's a lot going on with CCAP. Yeah.
Great. No, I mean, the reason for the curiosity is just because I'm wondering, just not seeing an increase in the budget. I was curious why and kind of how we can serve more families. So I would love to hear more about that too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that'll be part of the greater strategy as we talk at the mayor's level, you know, those conversations for how do we get child care to folks who can't afford it? Not just everybody, but also folks who are struggling to afford it as well.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Thank you, Councilwoman. We have about 25 minutes left for this briefing, and we have 4 council members in the queue. So next we have Pro Tem Romero Campbell, followed by President Sandoval.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I just want to say, you know, appreciation and gratitude also for setting up an outpost in Southeast Denver, co-locating with Rocky Mountain Human Services. It's in walking distance of a host neighborhood. It's been great. And I think that collaboration and partnership is just tremendous. Transportation is always an issue. And so having that so located in Southeast Denver is really, really great. So thank you for that. I do want to ask just a little bit more about Councilwoman Parody's question. I had a very similar, question, but now you've answered it. But I have my wondering around the number of families. Is it that we don't have the capacity for, like, I'm just thinking of this moving forward. So for CCAP, is it that we have a higher demand than what we have the ability to have enrolled or pay for? One, and then when I look at the chart on slide 27, we also see an increase in TANF. And so that makes me wonder that there's a higher need for families and families with young children. Can you just speak to that a little bit
more? Well, the one thing I can say, and I might ask y'all to weigh in because I know Mimi's really familiar with this program, but we have not carried a wait list for a long time. So there isn't like this wait. A lot of counties do carry a wait list. We don't. But I'm not sure all the reasons as to why. Like, I mean, I'm excited to meet with the providers because I haven't had a chance to actually talk with them directly yet. Working with our team, an amazing team who leads this. But it will be interesting to kind of learn more from their angle, like what's their experience. But do Mimi or Clint, I don't know. I know Clint, you've been dealing with the finance side a lot, but programmatically, I think Mimi might be best placed to.
Sure. Sherman, I think historically we have decided our fund balance is what we're going to use to cover the cost that the program allocation doesn't cover. And we have so many now competing priorities for all the monies, including TANF, including CCAP, including our over expenditures in every program that we have, which our fund balance is supposed to cover, that we are now at a position without the additional federal funds that we may have to make some different decisions. And at the same time, we are strongly advocating with the state and with the federal government as a county, like all 64 counties, to say, you can't do this to our families because you can't expect us to fund something that the money is not there to provide. And we want to support our providers, but we need to support our families. So how do you balance that out and get us the funding we need?
Thank you, and I would love to be able to have further discussion, and maybe this is a presentation that we'd have at safety at some point. It sounded like you are still in the kind of thinking and figuring it out as it moves forward.
Can I just ask a follow-up for you? Is your question, though, like, is 3,200 or 3,400, I can't remember now, that number, all the families that need it, or you were kind of asking, are there more families who potentially need it but don't know about it?
It's a little bit of a both and, okay, right? Okay. So if you addressed it with, if we don't have a wait list, and
yes.
I think sometimes the requirements that people have within CCAP to access it is one. But if we're looking at providers, we know that after COVID, there were a lot of childcare providers that the slots, you know,
yes.
a childcare slot,
yes.
those reduced.
Right.
So we don't even have the same capacity that
sure.
we had previously. And that's for licensed care, knowing that many of our children are being cared for in family, friend, and neighbor care, you know, settings. So kind of left out of the system, still being cared for, yet not able to access
additional
support and funding.
And programmatically, like a citywide effort is now underway with OCA, DDPHE, ourselves. We actually just had a kickoff meeting this week to say who all needs to be at this table. Sarah was there for newcomer program, about how are we going to meet the child care needs of all the residents of Denver with all the different programs we have. They're all with different agencies and across the board. So we're also trying to figure out how do we best serve everybody with the resources we all have.
Yeah. Thank you. And I will just seating on the other end of the continuum, right? Our adult services, our seniors. In the line item, I don't know if you want to speak a little bit more as to what additional strategies will be out there that need to be funded for our aging population.
Yeah, you know, to be honest, that's something that Director Vander and I are going to be meeting about to talk about and for me to learn more about. We spend about $6 million, I think was the number we prepared, just in case y'all asked more about that. But I know it's more than that. That was just for our adult protection and long-term care, maybe, yeah.
Property tax rebate.
So we grabbed what we could, like, definitively say this is adults. There's lots of programs we have that I think that there's data that we could tell us. I think we're spending more than that for sure, but it's not enough. And I think that we should be thinking about what are all the services, and with the Office of Aging and the work that Director Gaylor, I just gave you a bump in salary there, Director Gaylor, her team and our team wants to meet to have this conversation and figure out where are all the spaces and what other agencies at the city how are we talking about aging together and what are we doing in that space? Where are the resources going? What are the gaps? So we're still figuring that out. So I don't have like definitive answers, but having led the aging plan at CDPH years ago, you know, just aging in place is a huge piece. Behavioral health care, I think we kind of don't think of seniors as, I don't know, we don't talk about that very much. It's a huge piece. I'm watching my mother age right now, and yesterday I had to work from her house because she couldn't get her prescription and the doctor wouldn't call back. Like, there was all this coordination. I was doing care coordination yesterday, like on the ground with my mom, and I'm just like, this just seems too hard. This shouldn't be so hard, and she has resources. So I just think there's a lot of navigation, a lot of the things that are happening in other populations, but we need to be thinking about it a little differently with that population, I think.
Thank you, I appreciate that. Aging in place, thinking broadly with the collaboration of aging and community.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, absolutely. Thank you for saying
that. Thank you.
Thank
you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you. President Sandoval, you're up next with Councilwoman Lewis following.
Thank you. My question is about the property tax relief. How many people does that serve?
Do you know? It's in my slides. Hold on.
5,700 or 3,800, according to Tony, our expert.
Oh, thank you, Tony. Tony Bellucci, everybody. She makes us all this stuff happen. So say a little louder so I can say it again.
I think the average is probably about 3,700, 3,800.
3,700, 3,800. Okay.
The entire property tax year.
Okay, thank you. I was going to say 4,500, so I'm glad I did not answer that question.
And so the amount that's allocated this year would cover that amount, so like projected for 2025. Is that what I'm reading?
Yes. Go ahead.
So this program occurs in arrears. So we're talking about the property tax year. So folks are just now applying for last year's rebate. This is not a projected amount. This is a year-to-date amount in that final column. So I would expect by the time we got to the end of this tax year application that we would be more in line with this year's numbers.
So what do we have in the 2025 budget allocated?
The same 4.5 million with the approximately same people.
So has Dave just done an analysis based on your trash rebate? Like, are there people who could qualify for a trash rebate, like, who aren't qualifying for this? Because I just don't, it's really...
Can I actually just jump in to answer this? So Councilwoman Gilmore and I have...
No, but I'm asking I'm asking them if they've done the analysis. That's what I'm saying on the record. I know that you have.
Yeah, so I will just say HOST is going to take over this program, and HOST has warned us against using the trash rebate numbers. That was the number we initially looked at, and HOST felt really strongly that it's better for us to use state income data than it is for us to use the trash rebate data.
So HOST is going to take this over. Yeah. This will be transferred over into HOST.
We're in discussions about that. Whether that's the right place to be. So,
but they warned us specifically against that for some very specific reasons.
I think that's a bigger discussion, because I wonder if HOST has the capacity to, like, I don't know if anyone is in here has ever had a senior fill it out. I've gone as a council aide and actually have people fill it out. It's not easy. It's not like the easier, like if you don't have a computer, you have to get it printed and then you have to mail it, and it's kind of cumbersome.
I think this is probably another conversation, but I will share in my conversations with Dr. Reif. I think that it's they contract out with someone who helps with that work, and we would be making sure they have the funding to do that. We felt like I know that oftentimes people think, well, DHS will find all the people who need it, and we actually felt like HOST, well, and y'all know HOST used to be within our organization, and now that they moved out, we think they might be better positioned to actually find more folks who are eligible, because we feel like there are folks who are eligible who we haven't reached. So that's the conversations we're trying to have, is how do we get the money spent and get it out there to all the people who need it, and we're just trying to figure that out right now.
And so for the 2025 budget, what's allocated, remind me?
That's the 4.5.
4.5.
Yeah, good question though.
So that's all, and then I guess we'll just have to figure out, I think Nicole and Stephanie, we'll just have to figure out how we can make sure as the newcomer balance goes from DHS to HRCP, and if it's in general, or how that all gets sorted out. I think that will be something that everyone will be interested in. So just having more clarity around that at some time. It's budget season right now. I don't think we have to have it right now. But that is something that I will have questions on, like, because you'll still do Denver Human Services, just so we're all clear, you still have to do, Office of Emergency Management, critical care.
The mass care.
Yes. That's still something that will always fall under you.
Yes, and that's what the conversations, and why we're bringing someone in to help us. What are all the work streams? What are all the things that need to happen, and what would this look like? You know, and we're still have a surge plan, still try to figure out how we would handle all of that. So that's all in the discussions, and just making sure that, that we use that 12.5 the way we think we should. Like, we've told all of the team members are aware that quarter one, everyone has a role, and then after that, we might have different type of roles based on whatever Director Gaylor thinks, and the team, and all of us, we're going to do it together, but what that looks like. So there might be some additional changes in how that money is spent based on these conversations with the partners, which include other sister agencies like HOST and DITO and those folks. Yeah.
I just want to end on saying thank you. Not everyone comes into these positions having to have trauma bonding. And just was talking, like, looking at the mayor, remembering our first meeting with Council Torres and Perla, your director, Gaylor, and yourself at that hotel that November
Saturday morning
that we said we were going to be there for an hour. And I think we were there for five, maybe six. And so just want to say thank you, and thank you to all of the work that you've done over the last year, as Northwest Denver was like ground zero with having 300 person encampment. The phone calls that I would give you late at night, like just trying to triage and figure out how to best serve these residents, coordinate things and coordinate all the agencies. And that was like, I think you were here for a month, maybe I had met you prior.
3 weeks.
3 weeks.
Yeah.
So just want to say thank you and all your staff. I think the mayor said the other day, how many days have we been in an emergency in the last 4 years compared to the last 40 years?
More days in the last 4 years than in the previous 40 years combined.
Combined. And so that meant your staff. A lot of your staff were in the EOC. And I think people forget that, and we're still living that in the 2025 budget. So just want to call it out and say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great, thank you. Next up is Councilwoman Lewis, followed by Councilwoman Gonzalez Gutierrez. Just kidding.
The first one is, I was curious, and Councilwoman Romero Campbell kind of touched on this a bit with the aging population. I think in 2022 they were projecting that, and this is for all Americans, that we'd see an increase in those 65 and older to rise from like 17% of our population to 23% of our population. And so I'm curious as to if you all are using any of that data to project how much money you should be putting into the your budgets, like moving forward on 2024, 2025, and carry on. And it's a two-part question. And did you all use that data for 2025 to think about the folks who would be 65 and older in 2025 that may be more reliant on some of our services?
So it's an it's a perfect question. We're really trying to be data-driven. It's one of our goals this year, actually, is to make data-driven decisions in all of the things we do. We did not do that for this current year. We don't we don't have all the data we need, so we need to, there are some, like the census data and some of those things for sure, as you're mentioning, and having you know, one of our leads on the data research and evaluation group, Elisa Piscopo, she's helping us determine like what data should we be looking at, what matters the most, and crosswalking it and analyzing it with people living in poverty and where they live. Like, there's all these pieces, but we did not do that for this year. That is my hope for this next year, is that we do start asking those questions. Like, we've had the questions, but we haven't started delving into that yet. But it's absolutely where we want to go, so we are prepared, right? We're trying to think like 2 and 3 and 4 and 10 years ahead so that we're not stuck. I mean, even if I wouldn't be here, I don't want that person to be stuck at that point, right? So what should we be thinking about and planning for now so that we're in a good spot? So that's exactly the kind of questions, but we did not do that.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And I will say that we were, Council Torres and I were in, I just don't know your real name anymore. We're in a conversation, and we learned that there were seniors in our community for the first time who were experiencing homelessness because we, so I'm talking about, like, I think the example we received was someone in like their 70s or 80s. And so I just think about, like, with an aging population, what are the areas that we might need to be thinking about now so that we aren't seeing folks who have been housed in our community very long term not even having their basic needs met. I appreciate that. The second question is, I had a conversation with Sarah about the DOTS program, and one of the questions I had that's still kind of lingering is around the folks who came into the city new, who maybe didn't get the resources that they needed because there was that bottleneck, right, and you all trying to deal with such volume. And I am just curious if you all know how many newcomers are still in our city who might actually need support that may not have been able to get it previously, before we start thinking about shifting our budget in a way in 2025 without actually knowing who kind of exists in our population now.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't actually have that number.
Okay.
I'm looking back at Director Kaler. It's going to be nice. I don't think she does either, though. I'm not sure I've heard that one. Okay. But I do think it's a really good point, and that's one of the reasons why I think with the shift, right, like even us shifting it over to HRCP does not mean we're like, okay, all done, right? Like we're there as a partner, but that is the work that that she and her team are so good at, is like finding those folks and trying to figure out what are we going to do for all newcomers, or, and as I say newcomers, I'm like, or folks who've been here a while who are immigrants and trying to get services and try to figure, right, so how are we trying to do that? I know yours was specific to newcomers, but that is part of the conversation. Yeah, that's part of the conversation that we're having with this kind of dreaming up what is, I kind of am calling it phase three. I don't know if that's right or not, but I felt like I came into like the storm, you know, there was a storm and then there was a, okay, let's move it from emergency to program.
Sure.
And then we started that, we got it going, and then with DAS, with this last influx of folks, we were able to create that because of the different statuses that people had of those different phases. But then we're trying to get to this, like, okay, this, I don't, normal's not the right word, I don't like that word, but it's just this, like, baseline, kind of like, okay, the calm, proactively thinking, trying to help people phase, right? Like that phase three. And that's what we're going to be doing through this process over the next few months to kind of, or really several weeks. We're hoping to have it done in sooner than later, so that we know kind of what we're going to try. And it's going to shift even after that, right? Like we're going to have to be nimble. We need to stay nimble to all of that. But I think that's a really good question to ask. So I'll look into that for sure.
Thank
the number, because I don't know the number.
Thank you. And I'll just make a general comment to our mayor that it would just make me feel more confident that we are moving in the right direction if we just kind of had an idea of who exists in our city who might need those services, so that as we're looking at 2025, that you all can say with confidence that, you know, we've given folks the resources that they need, and we won't see an influx of folks in 2025 that we hadn't planned for based on those projections. So just...
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Yeah. That's it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Great. I just have a couple questions. One is regarding under child welfare when it comes to out-of-home placements for Denver kids on page 467. We see which one, which is great, and I want to thank you guys for being leaders when it comes to placing kids with kin, which is, I'm guessing, is both what we call like blood and non-blood relative kin, is that right? So thank you for doing that. And I know Denver has been a leader in that for a long time. When it comes to like the general out-of-home placements per month, and right, so I see like for 2024, it's estimate 500, and then projected or objective is staying at that 500. Is that just like a goal that the agency has, is to try to not go past 500? Is it just more of a goal, why it's the same kind of number?
Yeah, I think it's just an estimate. I don't, it's just like us trying, because for the last 15 to 20-ish years when we were at the state, like the out-of-home placements have been just plummeted. It used to be, Denver used to have like hundreds maybe of kids that starts with a D. We shut it down. What's the name of that? One of the placements.
Crisis
that,
Center.
Family Crisis Center?
No.
Devereaux.
Not Devereaux. Okay. It doesn't.
There's a bunch of them that
I've DRP. What is wrong? Okay. I've forgotten all the things I learned at the state. Sorry. It's a place for young men, specific. Okay.
They call it something else, but it was Ridgeview.
Okay. It was Ridgeview.
ROP.
ROP. I'm like, what is the acronym? I'm like, DRP. Thank you, ROP. We used to have hundreds of young people there. We do not have that anymore. It's like we've really shifted the way we are doing our practices. I'm also asking all the questions too, like making sure that, you know, we want to shift and make sure that folks, children and youth are in kin placements and such. But if and when they need those other behavioral health services, like the psychiatric treatment centers and those kinds of things, we need to find, at the state, we're actually working on this, trying to figure out places for those high acuity youth, and I know you probably remember that from your past position, but it has been decreasing generally over time, so I think that this is our best guess on where we're going to be, but to be honest, as the director, like, I want to make sure we're being responsive to whatever's happening, like, we, you know, as behavioral health services are flailing in our state, and I feel like that's a nice way of saying it, like we really need to be figuring out how in Denver, how do we protect and help support our folks. I know the state is working hard to try to improve. We have this BHA that we're really hopeful can do some good things, but with all of that, and the stress that parents have and the our economy, all those things, like if we needed to have more kids in placement and that was the right thing, I just want to do the right thing for the right kid, I guess is what I'm saying, right? And so hopefully we can continue our preventative work and so we can stay here, but it will just depend on the circumstances that come our way, if that makes sense. I don't know, Mimi, am I butchering that? Are you, is that okay? Okay, I just want to make sure, our child welfare expert over here.
So my last piece is more of just an ask. I don't expect you guys to have this information right now, so if you can just provide it.
Sure.
Well, one, in that out-of-home placement number, and I'm sure maybe it's available, I don't know if it's available online, but just kind of knowing the breakdown between foster home and residential placement, because I know that there's been a lot of shifting in that from the federal government and that the things that we've had to do with Families First.
Yes.
That has been in place now for what, five years?
Almost
5 years.
Yeah.
Because I know there's been a shift in like the level of care. But then the second thing is on slide 9 where you indicated court involved cases and you only pointed out dependency and neglect cases. I didn't see anything about juvenile justice involved cases, and so I would be curious to know how many that DHS is involved with that also have juvenile delinquency cases. I'd say both juvenile delinquency and maybe truancy. It would be good to know what that, where those crossover points are. But that's it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like we're wrapped up here on Denver Human Services. I want to thank you again, and also want to give. The things that we heard from Council President around all the work that you have done, that the agency has done over the last couple years, I would say at this point, because it's been a while, that you all were kind of thrown into that action. But thank you for that. Thank you for the ongoing work that you do and the constant work that you're doing to change with the times, right, and keep up with the times. So thank you so much. I'll turn it over to the mayor if there's anything you want to close with.
Just to say thank you both so much for the incredible service you're providing across the city. To remind you, as you said, that one of three Denverites access some of your services in one form or another. That's almost 200,000 Denverites who rely on this department every single day. And both your capacity to step in to a crisis like our newcomer needs and be able to serve those so wonderfully, and to have your staff be able to be really focused. It's hard to be focused on both the humanity of the work and the outcome of the work, to both say we're going to show up for you whatever you need, and we're going to make sure we focus obsessively about reducing our wait time on every single phone call. That requires two different mentalities at the same time, and your team has done that remarkably well, I think, to great success. We want to do that citywide. So thank you so much for your work, and thanks for being here today. Happy Wednesday.
All right. One more. And I'm going to change seats.
It's a beautiful day.